From NPR, this is Justice Talking. I'm Margo Adler. There are more people behind bars in the United States than any other country in the world. On today's show, criminal justice and the profit motive, American entrepreneurship or a conflict of interest.
Bail enforcement agents and bounty hunters have been around the United States since the time of the Wild West.
We'll talk about the bail bonds business and the private prison industry, including the experience of a former inmate.
Well, it certainly opened my eyes to a lot of things. And I should mention, when I first went to South Central, I was pretty much in favor of private prisons, at least in comparison to the god-awful state prisons we had, which had been under federal court order for over a decade.
Coming up after the news, free enterprise and the criminal justice system. This is Justice Talking from the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg Public Policy Center. I'm Margo Adler. A couple of months ago, the announcement that one in 100 American adults is in jail or prison made headlines. With our prison population growing, the private sector has grown with it. On today's show, we'll look at this public-private partnership and ask, is there a conflict of interest when profit and the justice system mix? Alex Tabarrok joins me now. He's an economics professor at George Mason University and research director for the Independent Institute. Welcome to Justice Talking.
Great to be here, Margo.
Alex, when did we first see the profit motive make its way into the criminal justice system?
Well, there's always been a profit motive in the criminal justice system, at least on the margins. More recently, we had the development of private prisons, beginning with the prison boom in the 1980s. And bail enforcement agents and bounty hunters have been around the United States since the time of the Wild West.
So sketch out some of the ways that our criminal justice system has for-profit elements besides private prisons.
When an accused, for example, is brought before a judge, and the judge says, well, maybe you're I'm going to release you on your own recognizance, or maybe I'm going to set bail. You have to pay $5,000. Well, often the accused doesn't have the $5,000, so he goes out and borrows the money from a bail enforcement agent. So the bail enforcement agent puts up the $5,000, and if the accused doesn't show for trial, it's the bail bondsman which is out the money. And because they don't want to be out the money, they want to send their kids to college just like everybody else, they send out a bounty hunter to go and recapture the defendant who has fleed.
Now, I understand that bail is sort of like a deposit. It's kind of an insurance that you'll show up for court. I don't exactly understand how the bail system works, who gets what money and when.
So the judge says you have to put up $5,000 in bail. Typically, the accused would put up about 10% of that to a bail bondsman. The bail bondsman then gives the $5,000 to the court. If the accused shows up for trial, the bail bondsman keeps the $500. If the accused fails to show, the bail bondsman is out the entire $5,000.
Am I right to believe that at first you basically paid money to the court and it was only later that we started seeing private enterprise come into the picture, or am I wrong?
It actually goes back to medieval England. And at that time, an accused defendant was kept in jail until a judge could show up. And the judges often took months to rove around England. And people say, well, this is a little bit unfair. This guy's got to stay in jail. So what happened is they developed a surety system where somebody stood in their place. And at first, the brother or the father who stood in the place literally stood in the place so that if the accused took off and then was judged guilty, the father or the brother would be hung. That seemed a little bit unfair. So it evolved into, okay, we're going to allow you to put up some money to guarantee. And in the United States, as society became more developed, you know, the purpose of putting up the money or having the surety was to get community involvement in bringing back and making sure that these accused defendants showed up for trial. And as society became more complex and dispersed, the commercial system developed as a natural extension of this surety system.
I know that the United States is one of the only countries in the world that allows private bail bond agents. In fact, I think the only other one is the Philippines. Some countries even make it illegal. So why don't other countries use this system?
I think the United States has a history of looking to incentives to make things work. And the bounty hunter, the bail system, is completely driven by incentives. And it does appear to work, because people who are released on commercial bail are more likely to show up than those released on their own recognizance. And if they do fail to show, they're more likely to be recaptured, and they're recaptured more quickly than when they are out on non-commercial bail or on recognizance.
And the bounty hunter, how long have they been around in the United States?
The bounty hunters, you know, certainly going back to the Wild Wild West, when you put the poster on the wall, wanted, you know, $500. So they've been around for a long time.
How did they get the power to go into private houses without a warrant, something police can't do? I mean, when I started thinking about it, I thought, you know, isn't this unconstitutional? Doesn't this violate the Fourth Amendment?
Well, it goes back to the beginnings of the system in medieval England, where everyone was to stay in jail until the judge came around. So when a surety stood in their place, they took the role of the jailer. So when a bail bondsman agrees to guarantee that the accused shows up, that means they are standing in the place of the jailer. And since the alternative is jail, the bail bondsmen have a lot of rights to bring these guys back if they flee.
So in other words, the bail bondsman can sort of go into that person's house or home because, in fact, they're really the jailer. This person really isn't free on some level. That's what you're saying.
That is correct.
Private prisons became more prevalent in the 1980s during the Reagan administration, a time when there was a lot more overcrowding. Mostly, I would presume, because of the war on drugs and stricter sentencing, you know, put more and more people behind bars. Were there private prisons before that?
Going back a long way, but certainly the modern history of private prisons begins around 1980, 1981, some of the very first contracts.
Some have argued that fundamentally criminal justice is about public safety. Do people have any business making a profit on something that some might say is the responsibility of the government?
Well, if the public wants safety, then they ought to get it in the most efficient way possible, you know, speaking as an economist. So my view is that if incentives work, we can save some money, and if we can encourage the bail bondsmen to go after the criminals and bring them in more quickly than the police would, that's a way of increasing safety.
Alex Tabarrok is an economics professor at George Mason University. Thank you so much for coming on our show.
Good talking with you.
We'll talk to a bail bondsman and a bounty hunter later in the show, but for now we'll focus on private prisons. There are about 112,000 people incarcerated in private facilities in the United States. My next guest became an outspoken activist against private prisons after spending 6 years in one, the South Central Correctional Facility in Clifton, Tennessee. He also spent 4 years in public prisons and jails for his armed robbery conviction. Alex Friedman is the associate editor of Prison Legal News and vice president of the Private Corrections Institute, which educates the public about what it sees as the dangers of prison privatization. Alex, how did your experience in a private prison compare to your experience in public facilities?
Well, on one level, they're very similar because a prison is a prison. You're still deprived of your liberty. You still have to follow the rules and guidelines and so forth, and you're still in prison. But when you start looking beyond that more obvious aspect, two main things. One is in terms of cost cutting. What I noticed in comparison to the state facility was fewer guards and cost cutting in terms of fewer things giving to prisoners, such as less blankets during the winter or rationed toilet paper. And as a result of, I guess, their emphasis on cutting costs in order to make profit, so they hire fewer people or they pay them less, they offer fewer benefits, and they provide less training and so on. 80% of any prison's operational costs, whether public or private, have to do with staffing. The problem with that is when you have less training and pay lower wages and offer fewer benefits, you have a lot of employee turnover, and the employee turnover rate for private prisons is much higher than in public prisons. According to some of their own figures, this is as high as around 52%. So as a result of this high turnover, you have inexperienced and less trained, less qualified staff at private prisons. And that translates into them being more susceptible to commit misconduct, to be bribed, to overlook rule violations.
Can you give us a couple of stories that illustrate what you experienced, the difference perhaps between what would happen in a public and a private facility?
Well, I mean, at South Central, I had a work supervisor who would accept packages from home for me himself and give them to me without checking. And we had a few other examples of that where employees were willing to accept things that were mailed to them and give them to prisoners without doing any kind of security checks, whether they were being bribed or whether because they weren't trained sufficiently. And that might not seem like something that's very important, but at South Central, because of one of these packages that a supervisor let in for one of his inmate buddies without checking it, which was a television, it contained escape tools, and four inmates cut out of the fence soon thereafter and left because he'd accepted that package for him. That kind of thing generally doesn't happen in public facilities.
I heard there was another story, something to do with floor plans.
I worked in the education department at South Central, and one of the assignments I was given was to draw fire evacuation diagrams for the facility. That included all the buildings on the compound. But it also included the administration building down front, and they provided me the floor plans for the administration building so I could draw those up. And that, of course, included the direct way to get out of the facility, which is a nice thing to know if you're in prison.
So it sounds to me like the main problems that you saw were sort of a kind of laxness that had to do with cost cutting. But I would imagine from the prisoner point of view that they might think that was better.
Actually, from a prisoner point of view, the things that are important to prisoners, absolutely. And prisoners found in general don't really care if they're housed in public or private prisons. In many cases, they'll prefer a private prison. For example, in Florida, the only prisons in Florida that are air-conditioned are private facilities. So obviously, that's a draw.
Ultimately, what impact did being in a private prison have on your life?
Well, it certainly opened my eyes to a lot of things. And I should mention, when I first went to South Central, I was pretty much in favor of private prisons, at least in comparison to the god-awful state prisons we had, which had been under federal court order for over a decade. But during my time at South Central, it really did open my eyes as to how our criminal justice system works, who the stakeholders are, who profits from that system, and turned me into a criminal justice activist, both on private prison issues, but also on the larger scheme of who we're putting in prison, how many we're putting in prison, and for what reasons, and what our ultimate societal goal is.
Alex Friedman is a former prisoner. He's the associate editor of Prison Legal News and vice president of the Private Corrections Institute. Thank you so much for coming on Justice Talking.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Coming up on Justice Talking, a representative from the largest private prison corporation in America makes the case for her industry.
This is now a credible industry. It's a part of today's correctional system. It's public-private partnership, and the debate is not public versus private.
But a state legislator says she thinks this kind of partnership is just plain wrong.
I just philosophically and entirely disagree on a profit, on a body, in a cell. And for those who don't know what a private prison is, you know, I've started to call them failure factories because I believe that's what the manufacturing is. It's a failure.
Stay with us. This is Justice Talking, the public radio show about law, justice, and American life. I'm Margo Adler. Today, one in 100 American adults is in prison or jail. It takes a lot of resources to house that many people. Some states are facing major problems with overcrowding. One solution has been private prisons, facilities that are managed by and sometimes built by for-profit corporations. Only about 5% of offenders are in private prisons. This includes both state and federal facilities. But some people, like Buffy McFadden, are up in arms about this kind of public-private partnership. Leanne Buffy McFadden is a state representative from Colorado. She has represented Colorado House District 47 since 2003. She joins me from Denver. Also with us is Louise Grant. She is Vice President of Marketing and Communications for the Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA, the country's oldest and largest operator of private prisons. We reached her in her office in Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome, both of you, to Justice Talking.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Buffy, let's start with you. I know you're an outspoken critic of privately run prisons. First, why has this become a big focus for you?
In the United States, out of any House or State Assembly district in the U.S., I do believe I may have the most prisons in a district. I have 12 prisons, 4 federal and 8 state prisons. And I call it the out of sight, out of mind complex. We incarcerate many people, but often they're not in everyone's neighborhood. Well, public safety is always in my neighborhood and in my district. And I hope to be a voice for those that work behind the walls. I call it the toughest job in law enforcement and the communities that host these facilities.
I understand that the ones in your district are all public prisons. Is that correct?
They are all public prisons, yes. But just outside of my district in the state, I live in Pueblo West, Colorado. The prisons are in Florence and Canyon City, Colorado. But I also have private facilities that I actually have constituents work at on the outskirts of my district.
And again, why has this become such a big focus for you? What do you think is at stake?
I have not heard a single presidential candidate speak much about incarceration, both either at the federal or local levels. Governor Ritter of the great state of Colorado has talked about lowering recidivism in Colorado and trying to stabilize the number of inmates we have in our system. I just philosophically and entirely disagree on a profit, on a body, in a cell. And for those who don't know what a private prison is, you know, I've started to call them failure factories because I believe that's the what the manufacturing is. It's a failure.
Louise, CCA started this industry. It's the largest owner and operator out there of private prisons. Why are these types of partnerships with private companies good for the public?
This is now a credible, credible industry. It's a part of today's correctional system. It's public-private partnership. And the debate is not public versus private. Federal agencies, state agencies, and local agencies across this country have recognized that the private sector is an effective part of today's correction system. We're helping states cost-efficiently meet overcrowded situations. We're offering very effective programming for the offenders in our care. And in the areas where we own our prisons, we are offering economic stimulus to communities in need.
Louise, your company operates prisons in almost half the states. What are the main reasons that states decide to contract with you?
States, as well as the federal agencies, are using the private sector for a number of key reasons. First is the flexibility that we provide to meet their immediate capacity needs. For instance, when states were having critical budget crunches in the 90s, they were not building new prison capacity, even though they knew that the inmate populations were rising. Today, many of those states face severe overcrowding. Overcrowding in a facility creates security risk to employees. It creates security risk to inmates and to the community. When CCA can provide immediate bed capacity to a state, that can effectively bring safer conditions to the state itself, to the state's own system. So we're a relief valve to the state.
Buffy, when you hear that companies like CCA are sort of brought in to solve an overcrowding problem that the state prison systems are clearly having, the demand for more prison space is likely to grow. So if the government can't meet the need, why shouldn't we turn to the private sector to alleviate the problem?
The general public just needs to ask the question. As a steward of the taxpayer dollars, my job is to either lower recidivism and maintain prison populations or even try to decrease those prison populations. When you have a stock-held company that specifically makes money off of ensuring that there are bodies in those cells, and we should explain that the private contractors are paid a per diem. They're paid per inmate per day. I don't know that it's very beneficial because in Colorado right now, we have almost 25% of our inmates in private beds. They're coming into Colorado, and it was stated in our joint budget committee that they said if they're not going to get more money, they'll dump one of our prisons. One of the private prisons will dump the inmates out and take California inmates, which are looking to pay more per day. Right now in the United States, you have a system that lobbies both at the nation's capital, and I know this because I've gone in and talked to staff persons at the nation's capital, the staff committee involving federal corrections. And also I sit in committee hearings where I see the private prison companies monitoring changes in sentencing laws. If we're looking to reduce sentencing, you'll see a whole host of private prison lobbyists sitting in the room. No, they won't come to the table and testify, but they sure are there trying to influence the vote.
Ms. McFadden, that is not true. We do not involve ourselves in sentencing. And Margo, if we look at this perspective, the private sector today has only 6% of the nation's incarcerated population. The nation's most respected correction system in this nation is the Federal Bureau of Prisons. They utilize the private sector, the U.S. Marshals Service, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So that's all three of the federal corrections agencies utilize public-private partnership. More than half of all states utilize public-private partnerships and dozens of local counties. If we were not a strong solution and partner to government, those correction systems would not rely on us and would not depend on us because their reputation is at stake every single day.
I want to take up a couple of things that Buffy said. I just want to push you a little, Louise, about this. One of them is perhaps saying that you're going to dump some of Colorado's inmates.
And that's absolutely false. With Colorado in particular, we have never in our negotiations with the state and in our partnership, said that we would displace a single offender.
Because the question Margo,
that is simply not true. I sat in my own budget hearings, and by the way, I know who the lobbyists are that lobby for the private prison industry. They have been in rooms monitoring legislation involving sentencing. So
the question I want to ask you though, Louise, is
yes.
Does the CCA have too much negotiating power over the state given the situation, given that the state has these needs?
Absolutely not. We have very strict contractual agreements with every single one of our partners, and we go to the table hand in hand. So it is truly a partnership. When we own and operate a facility, we have contractual agreements. Sometimes it's regarding the population, but many times it's not. The important thing to keep bringing to mind is that we are saving every single government agency who we contract with substantial dollars from an operational standpoint, so that those funds that they are not having to spend on their incarcerated population can be used for other important taxpayer services.
How much taxpayer money do private prisons save, in your view?
It averages 5 to 20% on daily operational cost. But another very important factor that needs to be mentioned now is when the private sector can build a facility itself, there are tremendous benefits to a state customer. For instance, with bureaucracy, it can take a typical state 5 to 6 years to build a new prison. Perhaps at a cost, an average cost, maybe it's $200 million, 1,000, 1,500 bed. 5 to 6 years. The governments very typically are having to go into public indebtedness, issuing bonds to pay for that. And that's without even having an individual inmate in there. They have to take out bonds.
And you
with
take
the private
how long?
Sector, and we have access to our own capital. We can build that facility in typically 12 to 15 months as opposed to 5 to 6 years. The government doesn't pay a single dollar of taxpayer money until that first inmate walks in our door.
Now let's let Buffy in here because I'm imagining that she would have a different view about the whole taxpayer and money saving question here.
I'm smiling. You know, I believe it was the largest riot in the state's history happened in Colorado at a CCA-owned facility in Crowley County. The irony for me is to suggest that they can build them sooner. That's great. I actually work in construction. I'm in the dirt pipe and utility business. I understand it very well. I can build a project sooner than the state can if I don't have to reach the same level of safety. The reason why it costs a lot more for the state to build higher custody facilities, because we deal with the toughest inmates, the higher custody inmates. You know, I could do things a lot cheaper too if I had the easiest inmates. But as soon as these inmates become a problem, whether they get mentally ill, very sick, violent, they're often sent back to the state and federal system. So I really take issue with it. They're a lot cheaper. I have yet to have that proven to me at all. You know, I could do a job cheaper too if the state picked up my transportation costs and all my ancillary costs as well.
Let me ask Louise now. The critics have argued that the staff of private prisons is less skilled, that it's constantly turning over, that they often save money, private prisons, through paying lower wages. So, you know, is this an instance where profit is being put before prison safety, Louise?
Two things that I'll say to respond to that, Margo. Again, when you look at our customers, the federal agencies and the state agencies, if our customers, the governors, the legislators, did not believe that we were providing sound, quality correctional management services, we would not be in business today. And in fact, in almost all instances with both our federal and our state customers, our populations are growing with them because they have greater confidence in us every year.
Louise Grant is Vice President of Marketing and Communications for the Correction Corporation of America, or CCA. Buffy McFadden is a state representative from Colorado. I'd like to turn to Buffy for a moment. When it comes to prison capacity, several states have taken to exporting their prisoners to other states and often to private prisons. Last year, concerning this issue, you told the Denver Post, quote, sending inmates out of state is almost guaranteeing 100% recidivism rate. What did you mean by that?
Exactly what I said. If you want to see an inmate fail, send them away from their support system. Send them away from where they may be paroled to. Send them away where they may be released to. Make it very difficult for them to have family visits and to maintain a positive attitude. Because when inmates are doing well and they have family visits and ties back to the community and they're preparing to leave the system, they have a better chance of maintaining and not ending up back in prison. That is crucial to reducing recidivism. We've actually disincentivized good behavior in our state system, because if you're really good in our state system and you're doing very well, you have more of a chance of ending up in an out-of-state bed.
Louise?
Certainly. Ms. McFadden's opinion is that families are important, and we wouldn't disagree at all. But we also know, and our experience shows as well, that what truly changes an offender is giving him opportunities, and that's while he's incarcerated, and that goes back to education, vocational, and substance abuse treatment. When you consider that today in a typical prison, 70 to 85% of offenders are in there because of drug-related charges or drug addictions, you realize it's not just about having them have family close by. The important thing is to make sure you're providing substance abuse treatment programming to those offenders while they're in our care. Similarly, when you look at education rates of some of these offenders, fourth, fifth grade reading levels, you realize we have to be providing education so that when they are released from prison, they have solid education skills, they have vocational skills, and they're not on the drugs. That's what keeps them out of prison.
We have just a minute more, and I'd love to have a final thought from each of you. Let's start with Buffy.
I just question across this country, you know, as we watch our government costs grow, especially with this war and our state governments when it comes to health care and to road building and bridges and to other costs like Medicaid, which is federally mandated, every time I have to put another dollar into a prison system, whether it be on the failure factory side or the public side, that's a dollar away from a family's public education system, a dollar away from the road and bridge and mass transit system. That's a dollar away from every need we have in government, public school system as well. And I would hope that this out of sight, out of mind problem would come to the awareness of the public and we start talking about this as a real problem. And I really hope our presidential candidates would start talking about it as a real problem.
Louise, a final thought.
When taxpayers are choosing how they'd like their money spent, we firmly believe that They would rather know that the corrections agencies at the state and federal level are using their dollars wisely. And that means using the private sector as a part of the nation's correction system, where we are bringing quality offender programming, quality operational safety and security, but we're doing it at less cost than the public sector. That makes sense for taxpayers, and that's why we believe all three of the federal agencies and more than half of the states continue to embrace public-private partnership in the nation's correction system today.
Louise Grant is Vice President of Marketing and Communications for the Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA. Buffy McFadden is a state representative from Colorado. Thank you both for talking with me today.
Thank you, Margo.
Thank you, Margo.
The United States is hardly unique in the world for using private prisons, but the bail bond system in America is a different story. In a number of countries, including England and Canada, it's a crime to pay someone's bail in exchange for money. Coming up on Justice Talking, a bail bondsman tells us why there should be a place for his trade in our criminal justice system.
You know, if there's nobody to hold these people accountable, then they're not going to come back to court.
And what happens when you don't show up for court? A bounty hunter is likely to come after you.
I can go out there 2, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning. I can walk into a church, arrest you in a church. If you are getting married, I'll arrest you right as you're getting married.
Stay with us.
Justice Talking is produced by the Annenberg Public Policy Center, a think tank at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. The program is made possible with support from the Annenberg Foundation. The foundation works to advance public well-being through improved communication. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and West Legal Ed Center, where lawyers can listen to Justice Talking for MCLE credit online at westlegaledcenter.com. And from Oxford University Press, publisher of the United States Constitution, What It Says, What It Means, a Hip Pocket Guide. The Hip Pocket Constitution is available at justicetalking.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Justice Talking has entered the blogosphere. Each day, check out a new commentary from one of our contributors who cares passionately about law and justice issues. At justicetalking.org, you can also find forums where you can weigh in on the issues we cover on Justice Talking, like the environment, criminal justice, religious freedom, and elections. Continue the debate online with other Justice Talking listeners at justicetalking.org. This is Justice Talking, where we make the connection between law, justice, and American life. I'm Margo Adler. Fighting crime in America has always had a for-profit element. Although the Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution bans excessive bail, there are times when it can be hard to come up with the cash to get out of jail. That's where a bail bond agent comes in. Gene Newman is a former president of Professional Bail Agents of the United States and the owner of the AAA Bonding Company. He's been in the bail business for more than three decades. Gene, welcome to Justice Talking.
Thank you.
The bail bonds industry has a strong selling point for arrestees. Often you can get people who get arrested out of jail quickly. Sometimes it's just a matter of hours. But you can pick and choose who you will help. How do you decide?
We decide based on whether or not we can get them back in court. It's not about what the charge is or what the circumstances are. It's strictly based on whether or not we can get that individual back in court to face the charge.
And given that it's not the charge, how do you tell?
Well, it's basically by putting financial handcuffs on them. We look at their family, their ties to the communities, and all that ties together as to whether or not we can bring them back to court.
Now, one thing that I know rankles critics of the system is they say that these are defendants who are innocent until proven guilty, and if a bondsman doesn't see an opportunity to make some money, the defendants sit in jail, and it's particularly true for very poor people who are sometimes sitting in jail for lack of $100 bail. Now, I realize that's not your job, to be fair. You're a businessman. But how do you respond to critics who say the justice system needs to be fair, you know, blind justice and all that?
Well, the justice system does need to be fair, and we are part of that part that makes it fair, because we're the ones that get the poor people out of jail. if a guy is stuck in jail on a $1,000 bond or a $10,000 bond or a $100,000 bond, we can work with the families and help get that person out of jail. The people who get stuck in jail, sadly, are not the people who are most of the time charged with crimes and are stuck there. It's the people who don't understand the system, and nobody in the system will help them understand the system.
Bail bond agents make their profit by keeping the money a defendant puts up to secure his or her bond, usually around 10% of whatever the figure the judge sets for bail. The gamble, I guess, for the bail agent is, you know, that the defendant will show up for trial. So how often do clients skip out?
Well, there's a National Bureau of Justice study that shows that defendants released on a bail bond miss court about 15% of the time. What that doesn't show is that 15%, the majority of them are simply cured with a phone call. The bail agent, in other words, can help them get right back to court and get it resolved. Only about 2% nationally out on bail skip that we have to pay.
Now, I know that a few states have moved to abolish private bail bonds. I believe Illinois, Kentucky, Oregon, and Wisconsin. And there are some other states that have made big investments in helping people who've been arrested to get out without having to pay money to a bail agent that they won't get back. I think Washington, D.C. is an example of that. So are you worried that these kinds of things will become more common?
No, I'm not, because if you go talk to the sheriffs in Kentucky and Illinois and Oregon and Wisconsin and those other places that have done that, if you talk to the law enforcement officers and they say, man, I've got so many warrants, I don't know what I'm doing because these people aren't coming back to court.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's nobody to hold these people accountable, then they're not going to come back to court. And when, you know, you take a guy who gets out, he was the first offender shoplifter. He goes down and he's booked into the jail, or he's simply given a ticket and let loose. Then he thinks, okay, well, nothing's going to happen to me. So he goes out and he does a house burglary, and they take him down to the jail and book him through, and they release him again on his own recognizance, or he puts up a little piece of money with the court, and they release him again. And you know, then the next time he's in for business burglary, and the next time he's in for armed robbery, and the next time he's in for murdering somebody, you know, in a carjacking or something. And, you know, Ed, that just feeds on itself more crime and bigger problems.
How has your industry, the bail bonds industry, changed over the decades? I know, for one, that there's more regulation than there used to be, but it still really varies from state to state. And in a few states, there isn't any regulation. So how does that work?
Well, the Professional Bail Agents of the United States has worked with all the states to try to get better laws that make it harder to get into bail bonding business and easier to be gotten out of as far as regulating bail agents. We want to make sure the people that are in the business are fair to the people that we're dealing with, and we're straightforward and we're honest. And the main thing that a bail agent does is make sure a defendant goes back to court. If we don't do that, to make sure that we go pick him up, and if we don't do that, to pay the full face amount of the bond.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what commercial bail is supposed to be about. And we, through the years, in Mississippi and all the different states, laws have been passed to make that happen.
That was Gene Newman. He's the owner of the AAA Bonding Company. An important partner in the bail bonds business is the bail enforcement agent or bounty hunter. If someone doesn't show up for court and flees, a bail bondsman can hire a bounty hunter to track him or her down and deliver the defendant to court. One bail enforcement agent has made quite a name for himself. He's called Dog the Bounty Hunter. And he has a show on A&E.
The fear and darkness all around you.
The popular program follows Dwayne Dog Chapman and his team as they pursue fugitives. While Dog the Bounty Hunter has been a hit with millions of viewers, at least one bail enforcement agent says the show gives people the wrong impression of the job. Frank Abramovich owns AMK Investigations, based in New Hampshire. He's a former police officer and a 20-year veteran bail enforcement agent.
Dog the Bounty Hunter gives a very bad reputation to every legal bail enforcement agent in this country. The way he addresses, the way he acts, the way he does things, none of us in the business do anything like he does. We don't run around with badges, jackets. We don't run around with pepper spray and all these equipment that he runs around with. We don't kick in doors like he does and all this.
So do you think, besides giving your profession a bad name, do you think it encourages bad practices in the industry?
Yes. I get calls probably 20 times a day at people to see his show. and want to become a bounty hunter, and the first words out of their mouth, can we carry a gun? Can we carry a badge? Can we carry a nightstick? We've seen it on Dog Show. That's what he does. That's the way, and people don't understand this is not the way we operate.
Now, you've said that in some cases you have more power than a police officer. In what way?
Well, see, a police officer goes home at 5 o'clock at night. He's all done. A bail enforcement agent doesn't get paid unless he's out there 24 hours around the clock till he captures his fugitive. Okay? When we say we have more power, we can kick in a door where a police officer cannot kick in a door. I can go out there 2, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning. I can walk into a church, arrest you in a church. If you're getting married, I'll arrest you right as you're getting married.
Each state regulates bail enforcement agents, usually through the Department of Insurance. Generally, what do these regulations require?
They require training, proper training, okay? And there's only a few schools out there that do this proper training. There's a lot of schools out there that teach, and a lot of these guys that do charge ridiculous prices. And there's a couple in New York where agents have gone out in the field and been arrested. And because of the badges they carry, the IDs they carry, and how they represent themselves.
So do you think the regulations are correct? Do they have the right kind of requirements? Are the states moving in the right direction?
Some of the states are and some of the states are not. Now, I'll give you a good example. The state of New Hampshire, okay, if I do an arrest in the state of New Hampshire, I have to go into the local police department, show them all the paperwork that I have from the bail bondsman. They take a copy of my identification. And usually who's ever in charge will send out not only one cruiser, he'll send out five or six police officers with me to do the arrest. They are the only state that I've ever worked in that they will give you the backup that's unbelievable. If other states would do the same thing as New Hampshire would do, I don't think a bail enforcement agent or a private investigator would ever have a problem bringing in a fugitive. In this country, 87% of the bail out there is done by myself and a lot of other bail enforcement agents. The balance is done by the local PD, by traffic stops, you know, or they're working a bar or something and they catch one of the fugitives that way.
There are some vocal critics out there who say the U.S. ought to follow in the footsteps of most of the rest of the world and do away with legal bounty hunting. The arguments center on the idea that too many of these agents are unprofessional cowboys. They bust down doors, they carry guns. Sometimes they're aiming those guns at the wrong people.
See, the problem there is you can go on the internet, you can go almost anywhere on any store. You can buy a badge that says bail enforcement agent, fugitive recovery agent. They've got all different titles on them. You can go into a company called NIC. You can go in there and buy a diploma for $10 that says you're a certified bail enforcement agent. And next thing you know, you've got these cowboys out there and these Rambos. They're running around with bulletproof vests on, badges, guns. You know, they don't know the laws. They don't know what they're supposed to do. They don't go out there the proper way, give the proper paperwork. They're kicking in a door. And a perfect example is back, oh, I'm going to say, several years ago, there was an episode out in Texas, Arizona, where the couple of guys kicked in a door. It was a drug deal, and they killed two people, and they claimed they were bounty hunters. And when it came out, the story was they were never bounty hunters. We just had that example up in New Hampshire. Three people just got arrested, and they claimed they were bounty hunters, and all the time, they were drug dealers trying to get drug information.
What made you decide to become a bail enforcement agent?
Well, that's a good question because I'll tell you how it really, I'll give you a good answer. Everybody that's an ex-law enforcement agent usually ends up owning a private investigation firm. And most of us private investigators, it states in our license, when we get our licenses, that we are entitled to go out any fugitive that's wanted for money. And that's how I got into it because, you know, a couple of bail bondsmen called me one day, asked me if I could do a bail for them. They gave me what they were making. I went out, did the cases, and I've been in it since.
That was Frank Abramovich, a bail enforcement agent who owns AMK Investigations based in New Hampshire.
The Bounty Hunter!
Well, bail bond agents and bounty hunters are an established part of our criminal justice system. They aren't without their critics. Along with charges of abuse and corruption, there is an additional concern held by many, including Tim Murray. Tim is the executive director of the Pretrial Justice Institute, an organization that advocates for reform of the bail system. Murray has also helped to develop standards on related issues for the American Bar Association. Welcome to Justice Talking.
Thank you for having me.
Just a few years ago, the ABA updated its standards on pretrial release, and those new standards must have been a welcome sight for you because they reiterated the ABA's long-standing call to abolish the bail bond system. What's the problem?
The system is inherently discriminatory against those who don't have the money to participate in the system. It does precious little to protect us from successful criminals who have the resources to purchase their release. And it leaves us jails full of poor people who simply cannot pay to secure their freedom pending trial.
Now, I'm going to confess that more than 44 years ago, I was arrested in a free speech civil rights protest, and I still remember the bail bond agent's name, Barish. He had the catchy slogan, "Don't languish in jail, call Barish for bail." I was really happy there was someone to help me out. I never questioned that there was a problem with this at the time. Was I naive?
No, you were able to engage a bondsman successfully because you had the money to do so. So, of course, you were happy to find them. And, of course, you were happy that they were able to secure your release. If you did not have the cash, if you did not have the resources, you would have languished in jail, as the bondsman slogan suggested you would. Wouldn't it be preferable, Margot, if someone had assessed the relative risk you posed, both to community safety and in terms of risk of flight, and then made a release decision based on those factors rather than basing that release decision on a dollar amount, a dollar amount that you may or may not be able to reach? And that, in essence, is the nucleus of bail reform in this country, to move judicial decision makers from simply articulating dollar amounts and instead having them assess the risk of flight and the risk of to community safety and make their release decisions accordingly.
A handful of states have abolished bail bonds: Illinois, Kentucky, Wisconsin, and Oregon. What led them to take that action?
I think that different things probably in each of those state systems, but the common thread was an acknowledgement that the bonding for profit system is inherently unfair, does nothing to address community safety, results in high pretrial detention rates, including individuals that in all likelihood won't even be sentenced to jail should they be found guilty, and an interest among those four states in replacing this anachronism with a system that is more transparent and more fair.
So you're king for the day. What's your better model? You know, I've read that many other countries don't make it a practice to set bail as high as judges in the U.S. do. What's the answer in your view?
Well, you know, you can get on a high horse, Margot, and say all these individuals are presumed innocent in our republic, and as such, they should be released until the state proves beyond a reasonable doubt that they are in fact guilty. But pragmatically, people are arrested on probable cause for the most part. My perfect state would include a neutral fact finder who would screen every arrestee, that would investigate their criminal history, and would suggest to the bail setting magistrate or judge a range of options that would address community safety and address risk of flight. That's going to involve calling bad guys, and calling people with whom we can take reasonable risk, those that would be eligible for some kind of release, in some cases, coupled with supervision. That would be dramatically different than what we currently have, because what we currently have are jails full of people that have had money bonds set that remain in jail pending trial. I would like to see our jails full of dangerous people, regardless of whether they're rich or poor.
Tim Murray is the executive director of the Pretrial Justice Institute. Thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
We've talked about how profit and criminal justice in our society sometimes go hand in hand. What do you think? Is justice being served? Does the profit motive help or hinder?
Share your views at justicetalking.org. You can post on our message boards, learn more about our guests, and sign up for our free podcast. And check out our blog, where many of the nation's leading commentators give their views on law and American life. Before closing, I want to say a fond farewell to one of our producers, Jean Barron. All of us at Justice Talking wish her well. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll tune in next week. I'm Margot Adler. Justice Talking is produced by Ingrid Lakey, Cara McGurk, Jean Barron, Viet Le, Julie Meshack, and Judy Jarvis. Gary Gaiman is our webmaster. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Engineering by Audio Post Philadelphia. The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the Annenberg Public Policy Center or National Public Radio. This is NPR's Justice Talking.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. From the Kauffman Foundation, featuring the book Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism, and the Economics of Growth and Prosperity, at kauffman.org. And from the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support, on the web at kresge.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.